How flexible is your device? Are you a person on the move and need your device to move with you? The Mesa Fundi goes wherever you go. It allows you to take notes, sketch your great ideas, sign documents and get work done wherever you are. Attach Microsoft Office for the ultimate experience. Make the shift and upgrade to the Mesa Fundi with Windows 10 Professional. The Mesa Fundi, flexibility reimagined. Available online and in store at all leading retailers. Mesa recommends Windows 10 Professional. Visit mesa.co.za for more information.
Put the action into transaction. Don't just be next level. Be on a whole other level. Do business with Vox. Get Vox Fiber to your business starting from 2,499 Rand per month. Level up your experience with uncapped calling, hardware rental, IT solutions, and over 160 other products to enhance your business. Work smart. Level up with Vox. Visit vox.co.za to view our range. T's and C's apply.
This is Tech Central. I'm Duncan MacLeod, and I'm on a call now with one of South Africa's best business exports, Vinnie Lingham, who's all the way over on the US West Coast. You're in San Diego, right, Vinnie?
I am indeed. Cool. I made the migration from Silicon Valley to San Diego about 15 months ago.
Why did you do that?
You know, I was trying to escape the coronavirus.
You had advanced warning, did you?
Yeah. No, you know what happened was I just realized, like, look, Silicon Valley is a densely populated area. And I grew up in, you know, East London and Cape Town, right? So for me, it was just too much. Like, when I lived in Johannesburg, Johannesburg was like a milder version of San Francisco.
Yeah.
And in the Bay Area. As an example, I lived in a suburb like close to where Google is, right? Mm. But my offices were in San Francisco. I used to spend an hour and 45 minutes commuting each way on most days.
Oh, right? On the 101.
Like the 280. Like, it would just get backed up. So it would be like some days, 2 hours and 50 minutes door to door, right?
Yeah.
Each way. I mean, it was ridiculous.
That's crazy.
And so I was like, you know what, this is stupid. Okay, I can fly from San Diego to San Francisco in less time. It takes like 55 minutes to an hour and 5 minutes for a flight from San Diego to San Francisco airport, and then like 15 minutes Uber in. I was like, okay, look, let's rethink things. So as a company, we decided to just, we had these expensive offices in San Francisco. You know, it's expensive, like the rent is nuts. You know, it's not because we were flashy. It's just expensive.
It's crazy.
And the company, you know, the team in San Francisco is about 15, still around 15-ish now. And what we found was we weren't always all in the office at the same time anyway, because people just had like life, you know, it happens, right? You go to here on a certain day, or you have meetings down south, etc. And we just found that we were just out of sync. So we said, look, why are we paying for the offices? Why are we spending 3-4 hours a day in traffic? Nobody wants to come into the office and work in the office anyway, and then you leave it like either 4 or 8 because of the traffic, right? And so we just said, let's just work from home and let's just regroup once a week. We did that, and we moved to like this virtual space where people would like get together once a week, a fortnight, and they would like, you know, we collaborate, but we would see each other. We would do Google Hangouts, and so we functioned as a decentralized company. I mean, we started off as a decentralized company anyway in the beginning, as we had developers in Cape Town and all over the world, and Berlin, etc. And so it was actually easier transitioning back to decentralized than it was most other companies. And so we're 30 odd people strong worldwide. We just use Slack and Google Hangouts. We don't need an office. And now with coronavirus, we're just not doing the weekly in person anymore. That's all. But it's working out fine. So because we were decentralizing the company, and this is about 18 months ago, really. It was just very easy for me to be, okay, where do I want to live, right? And San Diego is basically an American version of Cape Town.
I've heard a lot of people say that, actually. I've never been there myself, but it's right down south in California at the bottom.
It's the south. It's right on the Mexican border. Yeah. And the thing is like one of my best friends from Cape Town moved to San Diego about 12 years ago, the same time I moved to the U.S. And so we used to come down here every 6 months to see him. And so we decided, let's just move down, be closer to him. I've got some other, and then we've got a whole bunch of other good friends, South African friends who moved out here as well from Cape Town and from Joburg. And there's actually a pretty strong South African community here. There's a store called Perky's where you get all your Mrs. Ball's chutney and all that stuff. So it's a very like South African type place. And so we just said, look, let's just be down here. That was
That's cool.
And And I'm in the Bay Area. Like, I normally fly even sometimes two or three times a week. I'll fly up and down. Like, yeah. It's easier doing that than commuting.
Yeah, it's like Joburg, Durban, right?
It's exactly that. Yeah. Exactly that. Yeah.
So I was just saying before we started recording that I'm starting to get cabin fever because I've been locked in my home office for 5 days now. But you've been at home for 2 weeks. Is that when your lockdown started, or was that a self-imposed lockdown?
Well, the self-imposed lockdown started about, I would say, 3.5 weeks ago. I've been stockpiling since middle of February, early February, actually. I got my first messages. I was actually messaging someone about it. It was like 2nd of February. So the week of 2nd of February or the week after that, I was ordering like a new freezer for the house, like a chest freezer for the garage, stockpiling stuff in there, buying emergency supplies, et cetera, filling up the other fridges and freezers. And getting dry goods in the house. So we've been stockpiling for a month, like ahead of everyone else. I follow a couple of people on Twitter who are just really good at keeping you up to date with what's going on. And they gave me the heads up on this. Mm-hmm. And so, I was like, okay, this the numbers look real. You can't argue the numbers, right? It's extremely virulent. And so I took precautions there. But we only really locked down, fully locked down about 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. where we go out twice a week to get supplies. From the grocer, because what you wanted. So the reason for having like a deep sort of freezer and all that other stuff is if the food chain gets disrupted, which is what I'm concerned about, at least we have supplies there. But we're still trying to live week to week on whatever food we get from the grocer, etc. On a weekly basis. So that can disappear any point in time. We're already seeing shortages in the supply chain right now. So we've got the backup supply and we've got the regular supply. But the good news is San Diego is actually pretty open. So people are actually still at the beach. Social distancing is happening, though. People aren't hanging out next to each other. You can go to the beach and take a walk or whatever. There's definitely people walking around on the Esplanade type stuff. But you can see there's like very much a big social distancing approach to things. It's not as bad as New York. And remember, we're less densely populated, so you can get away with it, I think. They may lock it down further, but for now, it seems to be okay, and people are being responsible about it. We're not getting surfers arrested like J-Bay.
Yeah, the lockdown here is pretty nuts. I mean, they've...
I've seen some videos showing otherwise. I got videos from friends, like people, like the SASA people, for example, getting the social grants.
Yeah.
They're standing in lines. They're jumping into taxis with 15 people. I'm like, this is scary, Duncan.
Yeah.
Like, they're missing the whole point. I get they need the money. I get that they need the money, but the government needs to figure this out because you can't have a lockdown for the whole country and then people are just doing this.
That's true. That's true. But it's amazing, Vinny. Joburg is it's quite a leafy city, but normally when you're sitting in your house in your garden, you can hear the hum of the city behind you, the traffic, people, cars hooting, taxis hooting in the distance. And I was just standing outside this afternoon and I just thought to myself, this is amazing. I'm in the middle of Joburg. And there is dead silence. All I could hear was birds. There was not a car, not a hooter, not an alarm going off, nothing. It was just, it was as if I was in the rural Karoo, which is quite astonishing. My concern is what impact this is going to have long term on our economy. What are your thoughts around that?
So let's go back to the 2008 crisis. Okay, what happened in 2008 was interesting because the US went into this massive financial crisis. And it started to print money. Yeah. Okay, and we never really saw inflation hit as a result. And a large reason for that is that when the U.S. started printing money and inflating the currency, it made it a lot weaker versus foreign currencies. And so the rand got stronger, the euro got stronger, every other currency got stronger, and they were in a panic state, right? And the reason for this is, let's use an example of Daimler Chrysler or Audi. They're manufacturing cars. They're selling cars at a certain price point in the U.S. If the U.S. currency devalues 10, 15, 20%, that's revenue they lost because they can't reprice the vehicles in the U.S. It's a very different, big difference between a $50,000 car and a $65,000 car in the U.S., right? So you can't just like increase the prices to compensate. So you have to eat the loss as a foreign exporter to the U.S. So when the U.S. goes through a inflationary cycle, if foreign governments allow the U.S. dollar to get weak, they struggle to export to the U.S., which is one of their biggest markets. Does that make sense?
It does.
So in 2008, what happened was the foreign governments were buying up U.S. bonds and treasuries, left, right, and center, literally, because in order to prevent your currency from the dollar from getting too weak, you had to shore up dollars in your balance sheet to do that as the foreign government. And so the U.S. was able to stave off inflation because it pushed the balance of payments ready to foreign governments. Hey, listen, you don't buy these dollars, you can't export to our market. And that's what happened in that financial crisis. That was, and then that's a very subtle thing which people don't really get, because inflation never reared its ugly head in the U.S. And you know, everyone touts MMT as the, you know, the reason why. But like, MMT is one factor, I think. It's not only that. I think that you were able to generate massive foreign demand for U.S. dollars, which prevented inflation from hitting the U.S. Now we're in a totally different world. Now you have a situation where consumers are not spending. And any amount of stimulus that the U.S. government pumps in doesn't work because you can't spend. I can't go to a restaurant right now, sit down, have a $500 meal with like a whole bunch of friends and spend that money and buy some, you know, $30, $40, $50 wine. We can't do that. We're stuck at home. Yeah. I can't even see my friends. I'm doing like Zoom hangouts with them, right? So we can't spend. I can't jump on a plane and go to Vegas and go, Vegas is closed anyway. All the casinos are. I can't go to L.A. I can't fly to London. I can't go anywhere. We're stuck, okay? Everyone would like, so like, what do I do? What am I spending money on? Do you think I'm buying clothes? No, I'm buying food. I literally buying food, some vitamins. That's about it. You know, the odd gadget for the house here and there. That's it. Spending has been curtailed. I don't have a gas car, I've got a Tesla, but I don't spend any money on gas. Mm-hmm. I imagine a lot of people are not spending money on gas right now. Oil prices are plummeting, inflation, mm-hmm. which is a leading inflation driver. So you have this weird thing where US could spin into a deflationary cycle and no amount of stimulus can actually solve that problem, because you can't solve the structural issue right now that people can't go and spend, and there's no reason for them to spend. So stimulating the economy doesn't help because you can't do anything about it. Now that's, look, you could argue it's just that the major metros like the, you know, California, New York, maybe Chicago, but this thing's hitting everywhere. It's just a matter of time and everything will be shut down. There should be a national lockdown pretty soon, which affects consumption globally, right? Because the U.S. economy is not going to import as much. Like all the money is flowing right now into food. If you look at food sales, meat sales, everything, it's up double to 4x, depending on what it is.
So go long on supermarkets right now is what you're saying.
Well, you know, Walmart's hitting all-time highs as far as I know. The stock's up. I mean, Amazon's still doing pretty well. You know, so how do you combat this? I don't actually know. I don't have the answer. I don't think anyone has the answer right now. And printing money isn't going to create inflation because, maybe at the food level, but even then, the government is basically clamped down and the food administrations have already told grocers and supply chain, don't even think about raising your prices to take advantage of the situation.
Yeah.
Like orange juice is only up 20% or something. And I say only, it's like one item, which is just for whatever reason they liking, but people want orange juice. But, most dry good products, I mean, we're getting a whole bunch of stuff from Canada as well. This stuff's reasonably stable in terms of price. So I don't see inflation hitting the U.S. even with all this money being printed.
Yeah, that's interesting. And obviously the Fed doesn't have a huge amount of room to maneuver because interest rates are still at fairly low levels after the 2008 crash, right? So they've been cut to effectively zero now. They're flooding the market with...
Oh, that's the thing. It's cut to zero for more like the interbank and the more complex of, you know, the treasuries out there, et cetera. The mortgage market, the mortgage floating rates like 3.5%, 4%. Like what could happen is the Fed steps in and says, okay, we're going to get mortgage costs down lower and people can refinance their homes or automatically get discounts there. Because most people are paying in the 3-4% range for their mortgage. If that went down to 1-2%, it changes the whole structure. The bailout, I think, wasn't well done. The $2 trillion bailout wasn't a very good bailout, in my opinion. The bill was pretty, value versus cost. There's a lot of politicking involved in that. They could have just given money directly to people to help them through the down cycle. But here's the problem. Is that the rest of the world is about to go through this. So governments are going to be printing money, throughout the whole world to bail out the economies. And they don't have balance sheets as strong as the U.S. They don't have productivity as high as the U.S. in general, right? They don't have asset bases like the U.S. So what happens? You're going to have massive, massive devaluation of those currencies. And coupled with low propensity to import from the U.S. So you've got this weird sort of like stagflation, environment that's going to form globally. And Italy's in a world of pain. I mean, Italy's the third largest holder of gold in the world.
Good now, grief.
They're probably going to have to borrow money against that gold or sell that gold. And you know, if they sell the gold, it's going to impact the gold price dramatically. If they borrow against it, borrowing costs are pretty low. But, you know, to borrow that sort of level of funding is going to create, you know, I don't know what it creates inflation in Italy or Europe, but it's going to create some ripple effect. I'm not sure what it is. I'm not a macroeconomist in that perspective. But I can tell you now, like, you know, Italy and France as being, you know, like the two of the biggest gold holders in the world, it makes me a little nervous to think gold is a store of value. Because, like, if you remember in 1999, the Bank of England did some gold sales, tanked the price down massively. Like, that can happen again if they can't find money to borrow again.
Well, interestingly, gold has been a safe haven during times of crisis. And the gold price, I hadn't watched it that closely, but I think it has ticked up a little bit since the coronavirus epidemic started to spread around the world. Bitcoin, which has often been called the digital gold, we saw it spike up over the tensions, I think it was late last year, it could have been earlier this year, between America and Iran. And I think many people were expecting a global pandemic like this to be positive for cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. But certainly in the initial period of the weakening of the U.S. stock market and the sell down of assets, of equities and other assets, Bitcoin went tumbling down as well. Does that mean it's not actually the digital gold that some people thought it was?
Yeah, I mean, if you follow me on Twitter, you know I've been laughing at the whole digital gold thesis for a couple of years now.
Okay.
A lot of hate from the Bitcoin community. I mean, yeah, if you start off with what, when I got into Bitcoin back in 2012, it was really about a digital currency that you could use to move around. And what happened was we got into this impasse where, you know, the community was split on how to scale Bitcoin, and some people felt that it didn't need to scale because it's digital gold. You just hold it and it's up in value. And others like myself felt, well, yes, you need to increase the transaction throughput so that you can have more transactions going through the system. And there's some sacrifice there in terms of, you know, what level of centralization we need or decentralization we need as a community. And anyway, it's a big community split. We didn't agree. Those who felt that this was a store of value / digital gold mechanism where everyone who holds Bitcoin today in 4 years will become mega wealthy, they won the debate because it's enticing, right? It's like, hey, hold your Bitcoin, don't change anything, and it'll go up in price. The downside is it's just proved itself not to be a store of value in at least the short term, and maybe in the future, who knows. But it's become a piece of technology which is stagnated, and you know, it's pinned its hopes on Lightning Network, which is not ready yet after 5 years, and probably won't be ready ever, in my opinion. And it's not a great way to, you know, if you think that the U.S. economy is a liquidity crisis, can you imagine, you know, Bitcoin, which is actually pretty small in comparison, the types of liquidity crisis can form. So I'm of the opinion that Bitcoin is not a store of value. It may become, but the community may change their mind in terms of increasing the block size and other things. But the problem we have right now is that Bitcoin is highly correlated to the stock market.
Yeah.
And it was touted as being a non-correlated asset.
Yes.
And it's proven not to be the case. So if it is correlated to the stock market, then what's the point?
Yeah.
If it's not correlated, then I would agree that it's a great store of value. But it is correlated, and that's the problem. Gold is less correlated to the stock market than Bitcoin.
Some suggestions I read, I think it was a piece in the FT, said that the possible reason that Bitcoin sold off along with equities was that it was institutional shareholders who were allergic to high risk investments, they were getting out. And in fact, it's the Bitcoin faithful, the hodlers, they haven't sold, they're hanging on. The price drop was actually caused by institutional investors who only recently started to invest in crypto assets. What's your take on that?
It's probably true to some extent. I'm sure there's a number of compounding factors, but let's take this back a second, right? Mm-hmm. If you put your allocation of gold of Bitcoin into, let's say 5%, right, or 10% of your portfolio, let's say 5%, which is reasonably aggressive, but, you know, still conservative view, and you bought Bitcoin at that price, and your portfolio then tanked 50%. Now you're overweight Bitcoin. If Bitcoin held its ground, right? Mm-hmm. Now Bitcoin is worth, you know, 10% of your portfolio, and maybe people have asset managers be like, well, that's too high, overweight, we have to sell down. The problem is that Bitcoin fits into an existing portfolio of assets, and when the market moves, people will sell down everything to rebalance their portfolio to ensure that they're not overweight in any one asset bullish at any point in time. So this is the problem. Like as a, if it is correlated, it'll be sold down. If it's not correlated, then you'd be overweight in that asset. So it's not, it's difficult to hold it in a basket of currencies or basket of assets without it having some impact based upon what's happening in the market or any asset manager of scale. You know, the counterpoint here would be looking at stablecoins, right? Most of the stablecoins have risen 50% in liquidity or in reserves in the past month, right? So people are flowing out. So what's happened? So let me give you an example, right? If you're in South Africa right now, you've just seen the Rand go from 15 Rand 50 to what, 18 Rand right now?
Don't remind me.
In the past 30 days. Do you think, if you were thinking of getting out of the country or you were like really worried about where things are going, what would you buy? Put all your money into. And I'm saying all your money. You can buy some Bitcoin. Would you go 100% Bitcoin or 100% US dollars?
Dollars.
Right. And this is the reality in the rest of the world. Because Bitcoin has not proven itself to be a safe store of value, right? It's a speculative asset. You can make money, you can lose money. It's not a safe store of value. So if you've worked your whole life and you've amassed a fortune and you're seeing that the local government needs to print money, get yourself out of trouble. And so soft currencies, any currency I'd say outside the top five currencies worldwide are soft currencies. Soft currencies right now, people in foreign markets need to get their money out of those countries if they want to leave the country or even if they just want to protect their, whatever their hard-earned savings and what they've been working for their whole life. So you've got to go into hard currency. Bitcoin is not a hard currency. It's a highly speculative currency. It's maybe a store of value, maybe a digital gold, depending on your perspective on the narrative, whatever it is, but it's not there. So if you're going to put your money out, you're going to take it into US dollars, pound sterling, euro, Japanese yen, you know, one of those four, maybe there's, you know, a couple others on the list, but like my number one would obviously be US dollars. Mm-hmm. And then I'd probably go into the pound over the euro.
Yeah. Does that change at any point?
Even Canadian dollar. I'd go Canadian dollar over euro as well.
Oh, wow. Okay. Does that change for Bitcoin at any point in the future, or will it always just be a speculative asset?
No, it could. The problem with Bitcoin and what most people don't appreciate about Bitcoin is that Bitcoin has the liquidity pool around Bitcoin is actually very shallow. There's a lot of speculative buying. There's a lot of bots. There's a lot of buy-sell trade. And that's transient capital. It moves from one exchange to another based upon the price. So there's a lot of liquidity in terms of like price discovery in short bands. But when there's a big leg down, liquidity disappears. It gaps down. Bitcoin gaps down and gaps up because of the liquidity issue. And that's largely because the majority of transactions and trade on Bitcoin related are speculation, right? It's not long-term holders or sellers. Mm-hmm. It's different if the Bitcoin network is being used to fund or to process transactions for value, for goods sold, bought and sold. It would be, and that's what it was back in 2012, 2013, 2014. The people were exchanging for goods and services. So there was actual real value underpinning the transactions. So you could scale up to, you know, millions of transactions in theory over the course of a year, and people were using it to trade. And when you start attaching physical real world value to a digital exchange, you can actually create liquidity in the system, right? Because it's real liquidity, not I'm buying from this one exchange and selling another exchange simultaneously, because that creates fake volume. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fake volume in Bitcoin. So the problem is we've moved away from Bitcoin as a currency to Bitcoin as a speculative store of value with low liquidity pools and transient capital. And so this is what's affected Bitcoin. Now, Bitcoin can get to the point where it becomes a store of value and becomes digital gold in the future and fulfills the narrative that's being told right now.
How?
If you get to enough liquidity of real transactions happening, not speculation. But there's just too many bots right now. There's too much speculation and arbitraging happening on the network. And it's not the same as real goods and services being exchanged. And therefore, it doesn't have that as an anchor in the ecosystem. It's just people wanting to get in and out of Bitcoin for cash and for other things. So, look, I've kind of given up the sort of, you know, trying to explain to people how this works, because I've been doing it for 3 years. And everyone 3 years ago told me, Vinny, you're nuts. It's going to be 100,000 in a year. Ronnie Moes lost a bet with me last year as well, like 28,000 in a year's time. Like, it's just people don't appreciate how capital moves these markets and how much capital you need to sort of step up Bitcoin to the next level. It could totally happen, right? A government just may decide to print money and go buy Bitcoin. That potentially could push the price up. But again, it's all about the liquidity pool and how much liquidity is real versus arbitrage liquidity. So just back to the point, like I think you're going to see right now global demand for dollars soaring, right? So that offsets the inflationary issues for the US. So if you see global demand soaring, where people around the world, like yourselves, people in South Africa, I know lots of people in South Africa want dollars and around the world, they want to get out of their soft local currencies into US dollars. They don't want Bitcoin. And so this is where stable coins are coming in play quite nicely. Like, I could send you, or you could buy through a registered dealer or broker or exchange stable coins. You go, I want to go buy 100 US dollars, put it onto a non-custodial wallet, and that's yours, right? So you can leave the country at some point, and that money is theirs for you. And especially using your offshore allowance in South Africa, you can get money out of the country pretty easily, or at least move your existing assets into stable currency. The rand and other currencies are in for a lot of pain as Corona hits.
Yeah. So you think Mark Zuckerberg was onto something with Libra before it hit a regulatory brick wall?
I wasn't a big fan on the Basco currency and a single currency measure, because it's the same as the euro, right? The euro is a really bad measure of economic value, because the euro, the European zone, is like 50 countries all with different, debt profiles and productivity levels, and it's just a basket, right? Mm-hmm. And it's proven to be beneficial to certain countries like Germany and France, but less beneficial to other countries like Greece, right? And Italy. And so I'm not a big fan of that, the way it's done as well. It's sort of like monetary sort of union but politically separate. It's a complicated scenario. I mean, these things aren't easy. I do think that we over time are going to see a move away from these softer currencies, maybe even move to hard currency over time, where people say, look, certain governments collapse. It's really happening. I think Zimbabwe uses the US dollar primarily as a unit of account. And this goes into the unit of account, right? Like, the unit of account is probably more important than anything else. How do people do trade? It's a unit of account. The US dollar is the global unit of account right now. And actually, interesting enough, I think the petrodollar sort of debacle, where, I mean, OPEC and a few others were lining up to replace the US dollar as the currency for global petroleum trade, right? Until this whole debacle with OPEC and Russia and Saudi Arabia happened, that could have been conceivable, right? They say, hey, listen, we'll use the renminbi or we'll use another currency, and that could have massively impacted the US dollar. But right now, in this sort of trade war that they're having within their own sort of cabal, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. Well, we could talk about this stuff forever, but we should probably get onto Civic, which is the business you now run. Civic tackles identity fraud for consumers. Am I describing that correctly?
I think we started off in that area. Yeah. We started off with building identity solutions, and we built identity.com, which is it's an open source smart contract marketplace for exchanging personally identifiable information securely across a network with no central database housing all your personal information. You become the central store of all that information. And that's version one of our app, and we've used that pretty successfully in certain areas. We recently signed a deal with JCI, which owns Tyco, mm-hmm. Johnson Controls. And they've got these automated terminals and kiosks. So when you walk into a building, you can just use your phone to check in, and it verifies your ID, etc. So we built all this infrastructure. We created a token that plugs into the smart contracts, and you can do this quite independently. So it's very interesting. What we did was that we actually then looked at the market and realized, look, for this thing to really take off, you need to find a catalyst. And so Civic was said, okay, well, how do we take this identity wallet to the next level? And essentially, if we look at what a wallet is, it contains personal information and payment information. So we said, okay, let's layer on the payment stuff. So we built a non-custodial wallet, which basically means that we don't control your funds. You get private keys, and those keys are in the wallet, and you can store your funds, and we give you the tools to protect them, and we connect you with partners who will allow you to buy Bitcoin, sell Bitcoin, buy US dollars, sell US dollars, move money from your bank account in and out of the wallet. But we aren't a bank. We're not holding your funds. Mm-hmm. You have the keys. You have control. And it's typically what is known as a hot wallet. And we just announced today that all our wallets are insured up to $1 million through a partnership with CoinCover and effectively Lloyd's of London, as the largest insurer in the world. So you can now put whatever money you want to put into this wallet. You can put, you know, $1 million into this wallet, and it's insured against you losing your phone, dropping it into the toilet, breaking it, etc. Like, the funds are secure. You cannot ever lose access to this fund. And that's a really big deal, because people, you've heard the stories of a guy like lost his hard drive in a dumpster. Yes. in England, and this cannot happen with the Civic wallet. And if it does happen, you are insured. So it's a very big deal, because people often took their Bitcoins and their cryptocurrencies and put them in a cold storage to make it really safe and secure.
Yeah.
That you don't have to do cold storage anymore. Your funds are still on your phone. Your phone, if it gets bricked or destroyed, you always have access to your funds again.
Mm-hmm. Just take us through. Yeah. Just take us through how
we're the first wallet that does that.
Okay. So just take us through it, how it works, for someone who's coming to Civic for the first time, having a look at your website. What do they need to know?
So it's very simple. Like, right now there's a wait list because we're rolling it out. We've got a decent number of users signed up. We've got 150,000 on the wait list, and we're rolling it out pretty aggressively. We should empty out the wait list in the next 30 days. But
okay.
We're rolling it out as fast as we can because we want to make sure it's stable and secure. So how it works is you download the app. There's an insurance policy, so you have to verify your ID information, scan a passport or a driver's license, do facial recognition. That process helps us create keys for you. We place a key on the device, and we have with iOS, for example, we have a backup still going to your iCloud, so you can backup your keys then store them there.
And these are cryptographic keys.
Cryptographic keys, yeah. And all the data there. And the way we do it is we do it in such a way that we ensure that only you can re-access your device. So we have facial recognition in the app.
Okay.
So now you've got the app created. And depending on what country you're in, there's certain third parties we work with in each country. So in the US, we work with a company called Wire, and WYRE. And they allow you to tap into your bank account, pull funds from your bank account, and buy Bitcoin, for example, mm-hmm. on your wallet, or USD. Basically US dollars, and to store that in your wallet. And so those tokens move into your wallet, those Bitcoins, and now it's safe and sound in your wallet. And if you lose your wallet, those funds are still there.
Right.
And so that's really how it works. If you're in a foreign country like South Africa, or you're in any other part of the world, we have other partners launching in the next month or so. So we'll enable those things. So you'll be able to use RANDs to buy Bitcoin or to buy dollars and store it in the wallet. And now literally it's in your Civic wallet, and it's backed up on iCloud, et cetera. And even if anything happens to the iCloud backup or your phone, we can still restore it. And the reason is the wallet is designed in such a way, it uses a technology called multi-sig. And that means that there's three signatures that require, the three signatures that three keys that are able to recreate the wallet. And you just need two of those keys. So if you lose one, there's two other keys out there that can recombine once they prove that you are the owner of the wallet and restore your wallet. The other nice thing about this is you can store your money in this wallet, and if you die, okay, even if you don't want your spouse or anyone else to have access to your phone, if your will, you actually say, hey, listen, I want all my cryptocurrency, all my savings to go to my family, kids, whatever it is, we can work, like, as long as there's obviously the process of death certificates, verification, et cetera, but we can get the funds out and get it to your estate. And that's a big concern of people. And there's no seed phrase. You have to write a seed phrase down and store it safely, hope no one sees it. You don't have to do any of that. It's all identity-based. Mm-hmm. As long as we can verify that it's you and you've passed, we can get those funds back to your family. And that's a really big deal, actually. Because in the cryptocurrency world, there's countless wallets that have been locked that people can't access. And for secure reasons, it's a good reason not to give access to anyone, your wallet. But I think that the use case of funds recovery in the event of death is actually important.
Yeah. Does this appeal to people who particularly, nervous or don't trust the government, don't trust banks? Is this for people who want to take everything into their own hands because they don't trust third parties?
Well, you shouldn't trust third parties in general. Like, I mean, there's some level of trust. You wouldn't trust your entire life savings with third parties. I mean, this is why we have, FDIC insurance with banks as well, like up to $250,000 per account. if something happens to the bank, what happens to your money? People work their whole lives for these savings and they can't afford for it to disappear. You know, I think the way we look at this is we're trying to create a global money network where I can send you dollars, you can cash it out into rands, you can use your rands to buy dollars, you can send it to your Australian dollars, send it to a friend in Australia. And we're trying to build a money network where you can move money around the world pretty seamlessly. It's all identity-based. We do all the compliance regulations, checks, etc. The fully compliant wallet infrastructure, but you're in control of your money. There's no middleman. There's no bank that's lending out that money against those funds. There's no fractional reserve with those funds. And you know, especially when it comes to the cryptocurrency and your Ethereum, your Bitcoin, whatever, you can feel comfortable that you can store it safely and move it around the world. With the wallet, it's actually really cool because I can send you like a Bitcoin and I don't have to know your Bitcoin address. I just need to know your username and I can verify that that's you and I can send you a Bitcoin. So now no copying and pasting of addresses. We're trying to remove all that. We're trying to build a mass market consumer product around both cryptocurrencies and stable coins. And so consumers will not, just a cost to move, $1,000 from the US to South Africa would be nothing, effectively, right? And the biggest cost will be on your side, converting the dollars back to rands. We'll have providers that we have pre-negotiated deals with, and we should be able to get the cost down to a fraction of the rate that you pay right now with the traditional banks. But, you know, being able to cash out your rands into your local bank account. We've got some more news coming around how you'll be able to use those funds and the networks that form around it. But essentially, we're building a very, like, very secure money network. Remember, if Civic gets hacked, your funds are safe because we don't touch your we don't have your funds. That's the thing. Yeah. Like we're building a network of money where we don't touch any of it. We just give you the infrastructure to
use. You just facilitate it. Yeah,
it's literally a peer-to-peer money network.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, given the regulatory pushback we've seen around Facebook's Libra, are you finding that, are you seeing any sort of regulatory pushback from the US government or anywhere else in the world around what you're doing? And what are some of the regulatory issues that you've had to deal with?
So the difference between us and Facebook is we're non-custodial.
Okay.
We don't touch the funds. We're giving you software that allows you to pick up. You know, it's like the software that exists today for crypto wallets. We're effectively giving you software which you can run on your phone and you can store your own funds and move it around. We aren't, you know, with Facebook and Libra, they are custodians of the money. They'd have this big pot of funds there. And when it comes to Libra, like the biggest issue is like what goes into the basket of currency. Can governments influence what's in that basket?
Right.
This is like, if South African government today announced a stable coin, a rand stable coin, we can incorporate it into the wallet and use it straight away. You can move rands around South Africa cheaply. The banks would hate this, obviously, because they would lose, but like no fees, you could store your money. You could probably even get figure out some sort of interest package as well there, locally with partners. But like you could get stable rands in place and people wouldn't have to stand in line to get social grants. You could distribute the money instantly to people in their wallets. And you have the identity tied to the wallet, so you know exactly who's getting what. You could account for it on the blockchain. So, like, the technology exists for this. I don't think the world does, right? And the establishment is would be totally against this sort of technology. I know Investec is launching their own crypto wallet right now. And you know, South Africa definitely has a not invented yet syndrome, like many other places in the world. And so the question is, will consumers rise up to adopt new technologies faster than the banks and the industry can provide them? And in many cases, that seems to be true, especially in times of crisis. But I think our goal is just to be able to give people the ability to be in control of their own future. And so, you know, their own financial future. So we'll give you the tools. We are not, you know, when it comes to regulations, the U.S. Government has given, U.S. governments are the strictest financial regulations in the world, as you know.
Yes.
And we've gotten guidance from our attorneys. We've looked at FinCEN guidance, Financial Crimes Enforcement Network in the US. What we offer is a multi-sig, unhosted wallet service. Basically, we give you the wallet, you get to use it. And under those guidelines, we are not money transmitters. We're not holding the funds. We never touch the funds as a company. So literally, the guidance has been given, and our lawyers have concurred that our solution is a enablement solution. We don't touch funds.
Yeah. Do you think this would appeal to people in specific markets more than others? I'm thinking of places like Zimbabwe or Venezuela, where there's high inflation and you can't really trust the government and the currencies are collapsing and the value of your money is disappearing. Do you see value in people in markets like that using Civic?
Yeah, I do. I think that you know, look, we're not building something that's anti-government at all. We're building something which is pro-people, okay?
Okay.
So pro-choice. The way we look at it is, let's give people the ability to choose what they want to use to store their value, their wealth. So we are not a anti-government company. We're a pro-consumer and pro-human rights company, pro-privacy. We want you to be in control of your funds. We want you to be able to move it around where you want to. We think that it's a basic human right that you control your own finances, and we want to empower you. We want to empower you in such a way that you don't we don't touch your funds. We don't have your funds. We enable you to keep it. And so if you decide that you want to leave a country and take your funds out, you know, I think humans need the ability to move money around from whatever unit of account they want to. If you're operating in rands and you want to move to the UK, you need to be able to move your money, your rands, into dollars or into pounds or whatever currency you want to operate into. Okay, and so we enable that. We enable you to go from rands to dollars, from dollars to Bitcoin, from Bitcoin to whatever. Like I'm not going to tell you what currency you should leave your wealth in, but I can say that if you want to move currency out of a soft currency or something which you don't have much faith in, something harder, you should have that ability. I mean, we'd love to offer gold tokens in the wallet at some point as well. So these are things we're looking at, like how do we allow you to buy gold and hold gold in your wallet as well. So it's really more about enabling people and giving power to you and knowing that your funds are safe. I mean, $1 million guarantee is a pretty strong, safe insurance policy that you can't lose your funds. And we have, and the only thing it doesn't cover right now is theft, and we're working on that insurance as well. But if someone comes to you and, you know, holds a gun to your head and forces you to take the funds out, that's not covered because the funds would have moved. But in the future, like if you can prove, or if there's a real situation where, you know, your funds were stolen, and there is a way of insuring against that, having an insurance policy cover at least a portion of that. And then that comes in as the wallet advances over the next 12 months. We're going to have things like ATM limits, like a PIN limit where someone, you know, force you to take money out of your wallet. There's a limit. I can only move $1,000. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing else they can do about it. And by the time, by the time that the whole incident's resolved, you're only out of pocket. The same way someone steals your ATM card from you and you give them the PIN, they can only get that much money. So those limits will be in place in the future as well, and to protect you. So we want to be able to give bank-like infrastructure and features to consumers without being a bank.
Right? Yes.
And that's the goal here. So how do you, like I've often tweeted that, everyone always says about how do you bank the unbanked? And like, I would say, how do you unbank the banked? How do you build better solutions, better services, better products that are not banking products, right? And how do you get banked people to say, we don't want to be banked anymore because there's a better solution out there that doesn't require banking at the cost of that it has, and it's faster, cheaper, more secure, et cetera. How do we get to that? So the way we get to that is we just build better products that eventually will force the banks to either adopt or die.
Is your go-to-market strategy purely to get consumers to download the app, or is there an opportunity maybe to whitelist it and take it to market through corporate institutions?
Yeah, no, we're just doing consumers. We think that that's the best route to market. We have partners like JCR, for example, who will accept the wallet for transactions, and we've been working with other payment providers that will accept the funds, and that's fine. But we think that there's enough use cases of, I mean, for example, you could go online, you know, once you have access to the wallet and put a QR code on your screen and say, hey guys, I'd love, we're struggling in South Africa. I'm trying to raise money for whatever, helping people with coronavirus. Just scan this QR code using your Civic wallet and send some donations, and we can facilitate that for you.
Okay.
So this is the sort of thing, like we think that, the big opportunity for the Civic wallet is many to one transactions. So one person putting up a QR code or a username or handle, and many people sending funds to that address. But the difference with us is that because we have identity tied into the wallet, you know who the money's going to, and you can trust that it's going to go to, you know, Duncan McLeod, and not Connor McLeod.
Yeah, we're talking about the Highlander before we started, which I still haven't seen. Great. So we have a lot of South Africans who watch and listen to the Tech Central podcasts. If they haven't downloaded the app yet, and they download it now and they apply, they're likely to get access within the next month or so, you say?
Yeah. I think the wait list will be fully deployed by end of April. That's our hope. Okay. Obviously, if we have speed bumps and, you know, bugs here and there in certain countries. Because the thing is this, as we're rolling it out in certain countries, we may have certain bugs that we have to deal with. And we have different partners in each country we're rolling out. So, but we expect the next 30 days, 45 days max, mm-hmm. we think.
And Civic.com is the website where you go to.
Civic.com is the website. Yeah, you can see some screenshots of what the app looks like. It looks really good, and it works on Android and iOS. But we think it's the first step being able to be in control of your own fund.
Yeah,
it's a very, very important first step. No one's really had the ability to do this without going through. Yeah, I'm thinking like old school Bitcoin, like put money into cold storage. You still have to today. You have to generate a seed phrase, make sure that you're generating it offline so there's mm-hmm. no connectivity to the internet so no one can see what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You have to store that seed phrase very safely somewhere, make sure that it's, you know, weather resistant, hurricane resistant, whatever, that it can't be, you can't lose the ink on it or however you write it down. And then, you know, that's your key, that's your seed phrase to store your funds. And then you get a public key, you can put money into that fund, hope it's all safe. And you know, then you know, you could probably go get insurance somewhere that. But it's a process to do it. With us, it's like literally in a couple of minutes, you have a wallet that's insured for $1 million, and you can still fund safely and securely there. Mm-hmm. It's a game changer, we think, and we think a lot of people will be moving their funds, their Bitcoin, their Ethereum. We support Bitcoin, Ethereum, Civic tokens, and USDC at launch. But in the next 3 months, we'll be adding a whole bunch of new currency. We just obviously want to get the app out with.
Are there downloads from some countries that have surprised you? I mean, is the adoption particularly high in some markets that you perhaps weren't expecting?
We haven't rolled out wide enough yet to tell.
Okay.
So the wait list, like we're into the hundreds right now, and we'll go into the thousands by next week. But we're rolling it out. You know, we're rolling. It's invites are going out on a daily basis right now. Just as we onboard people, and the reason is we're trying to make sure this thing's the most stable, secure, reliable app. So as you roll out, we see, okay, here's a small bug. Let's fix that. Let's, you know, deploy a new fix. Mm. And most of these bugs are not security bugs. They're just stability bugs and, you know, memory handling bugs, etc. We're finding different phones obviously work differently. And Android's obviously a difficult beast with the fragmentation.
Yeah.
But, as we roll it out, we're more and more comfortable.
Cool.
I think we'll see adoption in certain countries more than others. I mean, South Africa would be a good example right now. Now, we don't have a digital rand yet, but if we did, it would be quite amazing because you could basically pay each other using a username and move money around instantly between people and using biometrics to secure transactions in the country. You can do that. You'd be able to do it in South Africa right now with US dollars. You'll be able to move dollars around amongst each other. So you'd have my handle. You could have your best friend's handle, you can pay them and you'd keep money in your Civic wallet. So it's actually very cool. It's very much like you guys haven't experienced Venmo yet in the US. It's a money network in the US. PayPal owns it. It's kind of similar to that where it's just usernames and we'll send money around. But Venmo is restricted to the US because the way it works. It's like they're custodians of your money. Because this is different, everyone holds their own money, we can make this a global network. Mm-hmm. And there's no banks in the middle.
Vinny, before I let you go, how often do you come out to South Africa these days?
You know, twice a year. Just not going to be twice this year.
Corona's stopping you.
I couldn't get flights if I tried.
Yeah, true, true. Yeah, there's no flights into South Africa at the moment.
Nothing
at all. I was on Flight Radar 24 the other day, and there was not a single flight over the whole country, which was absolutely amazing to see.
Yeah, my brother's stranded here right now. He came up here in March.
Okay.
And can't get back.
There are worse places in the world to be stranded. So.
Exactly.
But you're still quite active in the South African market. You're still involved with Newtown Partners with Luke Klassen, right?
Yeah. We just announced 2 weeks ago. We announced earlier this month the partnership with Imperial Logistics.
Yes, indeed. We ran that story on Tech Central.
That was great.
Yeah. And Silicon Cape, how's that going? You still involved there?
I'm not involved in Silicon Cape. I mean, myself and Justin did the launch, and we handed over to the community and said, "You guys drive this." And they've done a really good job.
Oh, I thought you were still somehow involved there.
No, just in spirit, I think. Spirit, I mean, okay. Look, Lou's involved and Newton Partners is involved as a contributor. I mean, we've got $20 million fund now to deploy capital into startups. So we're active investors. We've been investing through Newton Partners for years. We were the first investors in Sweep South. Like literally the first investor in.
Mm-hmm. They've done so well.
And they've done really well. They've created so many jobs. Yeah. That's a good example, by the way, of when I met Aisha and Alan, and I was judging this competition, and like we judged them to win. I said, I'll give you guys some cash, and we put money in, helped them with their business model quite a bit, and helped them through really tough times. I mean, these guys went through swings like you cannot believe.
Yeah.
But now I think they're employing 20,000 maids in the country.
It's amazing.
It's been an amazing success story. Those guys worked so hard, and we were the first investors to back them. And just shows like, you just need people to believe in you, and you can do great things,
and lots of hard work,
exactly.
which I'm sure Civic is proving to you as well.
Well, it's been a four year stretch for us so far. Yeah. Over 4 years of hard work to get to this point, and it's just not easy tech to build. And blockchain is like basically building an Ajax back in the early 2000s, right? Asynchronous JavaScript and XML where there were just no libraries involved. You had to roll your own code base, like literally. And it's kind of like that. And then the security risks and challenges of blockchain are not trifles. Blockchain takes twice as long as anything else right now.
Yeah. Well, Vinny, thanks so much for chatting to us. It's always great to talk to you. Vinny Lingham is co-founder and CEO of Civic. Thanks so much for your time, and we must grab a beer next time you're down here in South Africa.
Sounds good. Looking forward to it. Thanks, Duncan.